They're called the Comfort Women, South Koreans who were forced to provide sexual services to Japanese soldiers before and during the Second World War. They want compensation, but after so many decades, will they get any? And how is this affecting ties between Tokyo and Seoul? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Kim Vinell. South Koreans are marking 30 years since they began weekly protests against Japan's wartime sex slavery scandal. They're demanding a sincere apology and compensation for thousands of women who were victims of human and sex trafficking. Seoul and Tokyo reached an agreement in 2015 when Japan agreed to pay a total of almost $9 million. But last year, a South Korean court and the Unification Ministry concluded that was not enough, increasing tensions between the two nations. The Japanese Prime Minister, Fumio Kishida, who was foreign minister when the 2015 deal was done, last month urged South Korea to abide by the bilateral agreement, saying that at least the promise between states must be kept, or any discussion from now on will be meaningless. The term comfort women refers to a system of sexual slavery and was created and controlled by the Imperial Japanese government between 1932 and 1945. It is the largest case of government-sponsored human trafficking and sexual slavery in modern history. Based on the 2015 accord, Japan paid $8.7 million. The money was distributed through a foundation to former victims and the families of those who have since died. In 2019, the foundation was dissolved, with South Korean President Moon Jae-in deciding the deal agreed under the previous government failed to properly reflect the victims' wishes. And last year, a South Korean court ordered the Japanese government to pay further damages to former comfort women. Japan protested, but South Korea's Unification Ministry urged Japan on Tuesday to do more to help the victims and to heal their wounds. All right, let's bring in our guests. From Shizuoka, Seijiro Takeshita, Professor of Management at the University of Shizuoka. In Tokyo, Professor Craig Mark, who is a professor of international studies at Kyoritsu Women's University. And joining us from Stuttgart, Sae-won Koo, publisher of Korea Exposé, an independent media outlet. A very warm welcome to the program. First, though, we're going to talk to Malika Ear, who is Asia Programs Coordinator and Humanitarian Action Specialist at the Global Network of Women Peacebuilders. She joins us from New York. Thank you very much for joining us. So you were the lead researcher into a very comprehensive report looking into conflict-related sexual slavery. I want to talk first about comfort women. It's a euphemism, and it's a very poor euphemism, because the actual experience of what these women went through was horrific, wasn't it?
Yes, absolutely. The comfort women are victims of the most well-known occurrence of military sexual slavery. Hundreds of thousands of Korean, Taiwanese, Chinese, Filipino, and Dutch women, among others in Asia and the Pacific, were subjected to sexual slavery at the hands of the Japanese Imperial Army within their annexed or occupied territories during World War II as a part of a widespread military war crime system. And perhaps the most shocking and horrifying thing about this history of conflict-related sexual slavery is how systematized it was and how deeply ingrained into the Japanese military wartime strategy it was. And the comfort women, who are hundreds and thousands of them, have yet to receive justice and have it adequate survivor-centered relief and recovery. So they're still waiting for their horrifying experiences to be truly acknowledged and to be adequately receiving justice.
What is the impact of that sort of trauma? What does it do long term? I was reading some of the stories of some of these women, you know, taken against their will, subjected to rape dozens of times a day for a very long period of time. What does that do to somebody?
Yeah, I mean, conflict-related sexual violence, first of all, is a very broad term, and conflict-related sexual slavery is a small part of this broader term of horrifying violence that many women and gender nonconforming people experience. And one thing that's really important to acknowledge is that not only is there a component of sexual violence, but there are also other forms of violence that these survivors experience in tandem, including forced labor, forced marriage, forced sterilization, and sometimes even trafficking, amongst other forms of violence. And the impacts of this are psychological, they're physical, and societal. A lot of the survivors face a lot of stigma when they return to their communities, if they're able to. And it's very difficult for them to reintegrate themselves. Many have children born of rape and really struggle to raise those children or access safe abortions or even be able to cope with the trauma. So those are some of the impacts of sexual slavery.
Sexual slavery in times of war has not gone away, has it?
No, unfortunately not. Conflict-related sexual slavery is a widespread, systematic, institutionalized, and deliberate human rights abuse committed by state and non-state armed groups alike. And we've seen the context in which conflict-related sexual slavery occurs has evolved since World War II. And the rise of violent extremist groups and criminal networks has contributed to this widespread use of the bodies of women and girls as a form of currency in the political economy of war. Forced displacement, refugee crises, and humanitarian emergencies as a result of armed conflict have further exacerbated insecurity for women and girls, increasing their vulnerability to sexual slavery. And we've seen examples from Nigeria to Syria to Guatemala. So it's very, very present and insidious form of violence across the world.
Hey, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much for your time, Alika Iyer there from the Global Network of Women Peacebuilders. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, let's bring in the rest of our guests now as we turn specifically to the issue of comfort women. As I say, a very poor euphemism. I'd like to begin with Yusei Wong Ku in Stuttgart. Hundreds of thousands of victims. Between 2015 and 2016, the Japanese government seemed to go from apologising to denying the experience of these women. What's your assessment in terms of where things are at right now in Japan's attitude towards these women, in its attitude towards true remorse and redress?
Well, what you're describing is not really seen as a new phenomenon from the perspective of many Koreans. The position of the Japanese government, as seen by many Korean people, has been somewhat, fluctuating. So definitely there have been an official apology in 1997. We're talking about the Kono Statement. And also the Comfort Women Agreement in 2015 can be seen as part of that as well. But unofficially, there are comments made by the Japanese politicians and the Japanese government as well. They seem to question the importance of this agreement, importance of acknowledging this legacy. And these kind of statements continue to fuel a significant discontent in South Korea over whether Japan, in fact, is sincere about addressing the issue and having an active dialogue about what was actually done by itself in the colonial period. Mm. So that is really one source of tension as we move forward. And as we mark the 30th anniversary of the protest decrying Japan's recruitment of comfort women today, they continue to talk about the fact that Korea never really received, and the victims certainly never received, a sincere apology from Japan.
Okay, I'd like to pass over to Craig Mark in Tokyo. Do you agree with that assessment in terms of Japan's, how is it described, fluctuating response? Do you think Japan has shown true remorse, continues to show true remorse?
No, I wouldn't say Japan has continued to show remorse, certainly not from the recent governments under Shinzo Abe and now Prime Minister Fumio Kishida. As was mentioned at the start, Mr. Kishida was the foreign minister when the agreement was concluded in 2015 under the previous president, Park Geun-hye. And since President Moon, current president, decided to discontinue cooperation with the agreement in 2019. Ever since, the Japanese government's position has been that, well, it's up to South Korea to resume that agreement. And Mr. Kishida is in no mood to compromise on that stance at all, particularly when he's under pressure from the conservative elements in his ruling Liberal Democratic Party, who are largely responsible for him winning the leadership last October. And that includes former Prime Minister Abe, who is now head of the largest faction in the LDP. So I don't see any room for compromise on Mr. Kishida and the Japanese government's part at all.
Okay, I'd like to cross over to Seijiro Takeshita. Is there any issue with describing this as an agreement? I mean, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of women who were systematically raped, and then you pull out and you go to the politics of it, and we're talking about agreements between countries. I mean, what's your take on Japan's stance right now?
Well, Japan's stance is the fact that we can't go any further. The reason for this being is that there has been an agreement in 1965. The compensation claims was settled completely and final. And in addition, as Se-Win had been explaining, we've also had various other opportunities, especially in regards to comfort women. Back in 2000, I think it was 15, there has been further agreements. Now, the fact of the matter is, of course, whatever agreement you may have, whatever, you know, the coalition or the talks that you may have, the hurt and the pain and these deeds, you know, could never be, you know, compensated. That's a fact. But at the same time, we need to go forward. And especially considering the economic, you know, ties that we have in these two countries, it's very clear that we have to go forward. But the fact of the matter is what the Chinese High Court did in 2018 is basically saying that the wartime labor, for example, that ordered the Japanese firm to compensate the Koreans, is basically breaking all the international laws. In other words, they're acting almost like a backstreet drug dealer who have absolutely no respect at all on international agreements. And my opinion is, what can the Japanese government do under the situation where you're seeing virtually no agreement and the Korean government often taking the stance to utilize this as their political tool, because obviously Japan bashing is the easiest methodology of increasing popularity. So the fact of the matter is that it's very, very difficult, you know, for the Japanese government to make any official, for example, apologies, because they know that things only could get worse because they'll be taken advantage of. Let's not forget that, you know, after the 2018 decision by the Supreme Court in Korea, Japan's direct investment into Korea has declined by 41% in the first half of 2019. But for the rest of the world as well, it's dropped by 40% as well. The reason is very obvious. Nobody wants to have a deal with a country that has absolutely no respect of agreement. Now, I don't see why we have to mingle these things together. The fact of the matter is that we have to go on forward. We have to separate, you know, these issues from the emotional issues versus the economic and the politics.
Okay. I want to pass over to Se-Won Koo. Do you agree with that?
Well, we heard the expression being taken advantage of for apologizing, but the comparison many Koreans would make between Japan, with Japan is, of course, Germany. Germany being a country that committed wartime crimes that are internationally recognized and continues to apologize for them year after year. And they do not consider the fact that this may be something that they could be taken advantage of for. So if there is such an example, what stops Japan from doing the same when it's clear, not just from the perspective of Koreans, but also from the international community, United Nations included, and even activists in New York, that the comfort women system was criminal. So that is something to think about. At the same time, I believe the professor does raise an important point. Korea and Japan signed an international agreement. They said this is final and irreversible. So is it possible for Korea to say the deal is now off? And in fact, there are questions even within Korea as to whether this is possible. Let's not forget that the President Moon Jae-in and his former foreign minister, Kang Kyung-hwa, they never actually officially questioned the validity of the deal. What the government does instead is to engage in actions that certainly jeopardize the deal. For example, closing the foundation that manages the 1 billion yen compensation fund that Japan gave. And also, they're trying to say that whatever money that has so far been dispersed from this compensation fund will be made up by the South Korean government, and that the government will find a way to give that money back to Japan. But certainly, not everybody believes that this is possible.
Mm-hmm. Craig Mark, what's your assessment in terms of what all of this has done to Japan's relationship with South Korea?
Well, it's just one of the factors which has seen a deterioration in relations over recent years. It's not just this issue, it's also the dispute over the territorial waters between Japan and South Korea, particularly the Dokdo Islands, as claimed by Korea, and the Takeshima Islands, as claimed by Japan, that have been occupied by South Korea since the Korean War. And also other long-running issues of the legacy of the colonial era and trade disputes in general. Although, ironically, there are prospects for some improvement since the beginning of this year, the RCEP agreements, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, the massive multilateral trade deal has come into effect, linking China with most of the other states of the Asia Pacific, and that includes South Korea and Japan. So there is a prospect for some breakthrough in trade relations. But really, it's going to take some external efforts, I think, by allies of South Korea and Japan to try and get some mutual resolution, particularly the United States is, of course, the key ally for both Japan and South Korea. But even other countries, including Australia, which has good trade and security relations with both countries. So there's going to be quite a lot of diplomatic effort required from not just between South Korea and Japan, but amongst its partners in the region to try and get some progress happening.
Okay. So, Jiro Takeshita, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that Japan does not have a National Human Rights Commission. What does that say to you about its willingness and ability to confront human rights abuses of the past?
Well, the fact of the matter is that we are quite behind in quite a lot of issues, including, for example, you know, single parenthood. Only North Korea and Japan is a country that has that. Unfortunately, there's a lot of vested interest involved in this country, like many other countries. And for that reason, there are many things that are quite behind, especially towards the international standards, particularly in areas of like top management. That includes not only the corporations, but also the bureaucracy as well. So obviously, there are many issues that are quite late. But if you're trying to paint a picture that, for example, our human rights, I would say, acknowledgement or awareness is low, that is certainly not the case. Now, to put an analogy to this whole issue is quite simple, in my opinion. I think C1 has been giving a very good example about in comparison with Germany. But the fact of the matter is, and I agree with them, but the fact of the matter is what happens to Germany, how their attitudes will change if, for example, Poland or the Netherlands or other, you know, countries that they've been, you know, basically invading during World War II, including like countries like Greece. What if these countries have started to just basically shut down the factories of Siemens or Bosch or whatever, you know, Mercedes or whatever, and tell them that they have to basically settle the payment which had been agreed, you know, decades ago? The business will not go forward. And obviously, the main factor of these two countries is coalition on the economic side, especially with the aggression that we're seeing from China. The fact of the matter is that we do have to create a good coalition. And there's a lot of things that these two countries can basically learn from each other and basically create a lot of synergism. But unfortunately, it's showing a negative synergism at this point. And that basically comes from this, I would say, preoccupations and a lot of perception that has been created by the both parties, but I think particularly by the Korean politicians to the public of Korea.
Sae-won-koo, there is a lot of talk about, obviously, the agreements, the politics, what this has done to the economy. Has there been a re-victimization of these women who experienced these atrocities? They've been protesting for 30 years. What are they saying now, those that are left, what are they saying now about the impact that has on them, who have, the ones who have experienced all of this?
So as in the immediate aftermath of the 2015 agreement, many of the survivors came forward saying that they do not agree with this and that the government has no right to decide what they should settle for. But it's become increasingly difficult to really hear the voices of these survivors simply because many of them are no longer here. They have passed away. So in the absence of those voices, it has been quite, let's say, a cultural battle in Korea to determine just exactly how this Comfort Women legacy should be served. There has been a very important scandal in Korea involving one of the figureheads of this movement, Yoon Mi-hyang, who later ended up becoming a proportional representative in the National Assembly for the ruling party. She has been facing numerous allegations about embezzling funds that are meant to assist these survivors, and it certainly has discredited this campaign to a certain extent. And also, there have been instances where certain other voices about the Comfort Women legacy are being silenced. A good example is a book by a professor named Pang Yu-ha at Sejong University. She wrote a book about the Comfort Women issue, and she had different takes on the matter from what the mainstream historiography will call for. And for that reason, the book has been censored and her career has been in trouble. And she's also facing various lawsuits. So it is a very difficult climate also in Korea, where different opinions can be expressed about the Comfort Women, precisely because Comfort Women themselves are not necessarily in a position to say what they really went through anymore.
Okay, we're coming to the end of the program. We've got about a minute left. Craig, Mark, I'd like to end with you. How do you think this is going to play out, this disagreement over the agreement around Comfort Women and the legacy?
Well, I don't think anything has any prospect of moving ahead until at least after the elections for the South Korean president due in March. Depending on who is the new president, that might have the chance for a circuit breaker. And also after the upper house elections in July. If Mr. Kishida performs well enough there, he'll be able to have a bit more political leeway domestically to possibly move ahead and try and resolve this issue. But there's probably not going to be any diplomatic movement ahead of those domestic elections.
All right. Thank you to all of our guests, Seijiro Takeshita, Craig Mark and Sae-won-koo. And thank you too for watching. You can see the program again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is @AJInsideStory. From me, Kim Vanel, and the whole team here in Doha. Bye-bye for now.